Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Gungaloo Country in Queensland. And before we dive into our conversation today, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
The Lentil Intervention is an Australasian educational and advocacy platform dedicated to raising awareness about the current climate and health crises.
And on this podcast, we invite guests to chat about topics that will inspire you to take action to improve your own health and the health of the planet.
So please subscribe to and share this podcast and visit our website for the full show notes.
And don't forget to buy us a coffee if you'd like to support our work.
And here we are, the week of another hot off the press release of another IPCC report, this time on the mitigation of climate change. So you'll recall just two episodes ago, we chatted to Dr. Greta Petzl, lead author of the IPCC Working Group 2's report on impacts, adaptation and vulnerability, a mouthful still to this day. So this one follows on with mitigations. Now, this episode itself is not dedicated to the report, but we somehow managed to align our next guest so perfectly that the conversation totally overlaps, which means we will touch on some of the key outtakes.
That's right, Ben. So today we're talking to Dr. Carolyn Orr, who is a neurologist and clinician researcher based in Western Australia, where she specializes in degenerative brain diseases. But Carolyn is also a member of Doctors for the Environment Australia and is an advocate against fossil fuels in the interest of human health. Recently, Dr. Orr delivered an incredibly powerful TEDx speech where she so eloquently explained the link between fossil fuels, climate change, and human health. And we are very grateful to be able to unpack these topics a little with Carolyn today, especially because, as Ben said, we're recording this hot on the heels of that latest IPCC report. So Dr. Orr, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation, Emma and Ben.
Now, Carolyn, we were having a little bit of a laugh before we hit the record button, and you were telling us how you took 5 months of nothing but dedicating yourself to prepare for that wonderful TEDx presentation, which we'll have a link to in our show notes. But I really hope it didn't take you that long to prepare for a chat with us.
No, I think my husband would divorce me if that was the case.
So to kick things off, Carolyn, reading your bio, it's certainly fascinating. So can we just start off with the usual, tell us about yourself, your background, and what you do?
Well, thank you. I'm a neurologist. I started off in Glasgow, Scotland, if you're wondering about the accent. And I've worked in various countries, including the UK, South Africa, Ireland, the US. About 20 years ago, I ended up in Sydney and I worked there for the best part of 2 decades. And then I transferred across to Western Australia and I work as a neurologist here. I spend most of my time looking after humans with degenerative brain diseases, so Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's and dementia, particularly young dementia. I also do a little bit of clinical research and an awful lot of teaching. Outside of that, I'm a mother of 2 girls who are my pride, my joy, and my hope for the future. And yeah, the environmental stuff is an ever-increasing side gig these days.
So we've got to ask, being a neurologist, how did you end up getting into environmental medicine?
So I really wasn't someone that grew up with an interest in this. I wasn't a greenie in my 20s or 30s. I was happily oblivious to all of these concerns. And around about 2018, I was reading a newspaper called The Guardian, and I saw one article that I couldn't get out of my head. And it was actually nothing to do with climate change or pollution. It was about animal life. And the article was that 60% of animal life has been wiped out since 1970. And I was born in 1972. And I thought, that's basically over my lifetime. 60%, 6 out of 10 animals have been destroyed over my lifetime. And I thought, that can't possibly be right. They must have got that wrong. So I tracked down the source, which was a World Wildlife Fund report, and read it and couldn't believe that it was true. And after that, instead of ignoring environmental articles, I started clicking on them to read them, mostly to disprove what I'd just read. And over time, I began to realise that there was a huge issue going on with climate change and pollution and loss of biodiversity and mass species extinction. And without realising it, I was educating myself in all of this. And at some point, I had to make the choice. Now, one of my favourite films is The Matrix. And if you remember The Matrix, we've got this guy called Neo who lives in this perfectly pleasant world, and he just knows there's something a bit wrong with it. And he gets the choice of taking a red pill or a blue pill. And if you take the blue pill, you stay in your safe, happy world and you don't think about uncomfortable things. But if you take the red pill, you see the world as it really is. And I chose to take the red pill and not look away and to do something about this. And somehow over the course of several years, I became from someone that was worried about this to someone that was doing something about this. So I surprised myself, I guess.
I think that's how a lot of us have fallen into this. You know, none of us, well, excluding yourself, because I think you've got way more qualifications in this. But, you know, for Emma and I, it's a passion project. It's a huge interest, but we constantly, I don't know, Emma, we don't necessarily doubt ourselves, but we sometimes find ourselves so deep into something that I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm reading. I feel like I know less, but it's that genuine, what is it about us? It's more than care, but you know, we want to learn more. We need to understand. And sometimes it's to disprove something that just doesn't seem right, believable. And yet we just find more truth.
It is. And you know, a lot of my colleagues and friends consider this my hobby. And I think this isn't my hobby. I don't want to do this. I do this because I feel morally obliged to do it, and because I can't look away, and because I've got children that I care about. And so I think we do this because we feel compelled to do it, not because we need something to fill up our spare time.
Yeah, I agree. You know, like I was working in health as a dietitian, and all of a sudden I'm back at university studying climate adaptation, and I never wanted to go back to university, but it's just like, yeah, you have to do this. Once you know, you can't put your blinkers back on and ignore the science. It's, yeah.
Yeah. Now, we always have a saying that if you're in a position to make change or to make a positive impact, you're obliged to.
I think Spider-Man put it better. With great power comes great responsibility.
So let's kick on here and get straight into the nitty gritty, the dirty stuff. And it's a nice segue into the whole concept of pollution. Now, you talk about your passion, your interests, and what you've delved into. And there's clearly a link, but can you talk to us a little bit about what is environmental pollution? What does that actually mean?
So pollution, in essence, is the contamination of air, water, or soil by substances that are harmful for human health. And it's simply enormous in terms of health impact. According to the World Health Organization, pollution is the largest environmental cause of disease and the third biggest cause of disease overall. And if you're curious about what has the top two positions? High blood pressure is the biggest killer, and bad diet, Emma, is the second. But pollution is the third biggest cause of disease in our world. And it causes about 9 million deaths a year, and that's probably a considerate underestimate. And pollution's kind of like an iceberg. There's what we can see in front of us and what we know is under the surface that we don't know enough about yet. So we know quite a lot about air pollution. We know quite a lot about water pollution. But we don't know so much about soil pollution. And there's a couple of new emerging areas, chemical pollution and plastic pollution, where we're really only beginning to understand the harmful effects of these. And there's going to be a lot of action in this. And so we're undercounting all of that because our statistics are mainly about air pollution. What is air pollution? Well, air pollution is toxins that we breathe into our lungs. And it's a complex cocktail of solid particles, liquid droplets, and gaseous chemicals. The solid particles are particulate matter, or PM for short, and these are little solid particles that can get into our lungs and get breathed. If they're small enough, they get breathed in, they can go through our bloodstream and really affect absolutely every organ in the body. And we've got gases like nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, carbon monoxide, and even ozone. And then we've got liquid droplets like, this is a bit of a mouthful, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are things like benzene, so known cancer-causing agents, known agents that are harmful to the nervous system, and things like heavy metals, which we've known have been horrendous for human health for decades.
So what are some of the major causes or sources of air pollution?
So outside our homes, air pollution comes from coal plants, from gas extraction, and from mining and other heavy industries. It comes from the vehicles that we drive, and it comes from farming, particularly fertilisers. But the biggest single preventable cause of air pollution is fossil fuels. That's coal, oil and gas. So the same things that are driving climate change, our biggest health threat in the medium to long term, is the major cause of air pollution, which is an enormous health problem now. Now, inside our homes, air pollution comes amazingly from wood heaters and the gas you use to cook your food. So, for example, if you've got a wood heater in your house, one evening's running a wood heater generates more smoke than 5,000 cigarettes. And did you know that 1 in 8 of childhood asthma cases is believed to come from the gas we use to cook our food?
So to all the chefs out there that are so strict about only using gas, maybe they should reconsider that, hey?
It's time for an induction electric cooker run from renewable energy. Absolutely no question about that one.
And I've actually recently come across an article, and I'm scanning my notes and I just can't find it, but something that even... it's not just when you're cooking, even when it's when you think the stove is switched off, that there's this constant leakage of gas that's being emitted into your home, into your environment.
People think it's benign because it's literally in our kitchens, but gas or natural gas or LNG, liquefied natural gas, it's basically about 80% methane, which is really toxic and obviously a big greenhouse gas. And you're right, the majority of it that comes into our houses is not from when we're cooking. It's when the hob's actually off, which I find amazing.
Yeah. And a lot of homes, I don't know the status in Australia, but a lot of newer homes even are, you know, gas heating the water. So, you know, it might be just outside a bathroom window and there's these massive cylinders. So it's not just the stove now. It's potentially a lot more amenities within the home that's heated, which means you've got bigger cylinders, more gas being constantly emitted into the atmosphere.
Yeah, and we don't regulate indoor air pollution in Australia.
So on that though, I mean, the World Health Organization do have these air quality guidelines, but you mentioned the particulate size before, and depending on how fine that particulate matter is, it's not exactly a huge amount that you actually need to be exposed to before it starts to cause health issues. Is that correct?
So probably the biggest villain of all of them is PM or particulate matter, particularly PM 2.5. And what that is particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns. Now, I think that's about a 30th the size, the width of a human hair. And that can get right through our lungs and into the blood and go to all parts of the body. And going back to the early noughties, there were these regulations about that the World Health Organization put out whereby you are allowed to have this much PM 2.5 and this much nitrous oxide and this much sulfur dioxide and so on and so on. And what happened is last year, the WHO dramatically tightened up on those recommendations because it's been recognised just how toxic this stuff is. They halved the allowable PM 2.5 and they dropped the nitrous oxide to a quarter of their previous recommendation. So this was really an amazingly dramatic tightening up. But what they really flagged was that even these limits aren't safe. So there is no safe lower limit for most airborne pollutants. So it's like lead. We know there's no safe limit for lead in human beings. There's no safe limit for PM 2.5 and no safe limit for nitrous oxide.
So we've greatly tightened the amounts that, you know, we can safely be exposed. Well, there is no amount that we can safely be exposed to.
The problem is, though, that we haven't actually put any of this into effect. So Australia's current regulation system is based on those old guidelines. And even there, when we monitor this very poorly, we don't have enough air monitoring systems to cover our continent and we don't enforce them. So we've got an out-of-date, unregulated, toothless system that's just not doing the job. And people don't think that this is an Australian or a New Zealand problem. But I was looking up statistics before this and there was a big paper that came out from Harvard just a few months ago. And it thinks that, and from that paper, which is extremely well regarded, we've got about 5,700 deaths annually from air pollution that comes from fossil fuels in Australia. That's about 4% of all Australian deaths. The statistic in New Zealand was about 320 deaths each year for New Zealand. That's 1% of New Zealand deaths. So we think we have clean air in Australasia. We really don't. We're not as bad as places like Iran or China or India, but this is definitely an Australasian problem.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize how significant the impact actually can be, and across the whole life cycle. So obviously we know about the issue to the respiratory system, but what kind of threats does this pose to our health? It's not just restricted to our lung and cardiovascular system, is it?
Well, most of the research has been done on the lungs and the heart, but really air pollution affects practically every organ in the body. This is extremely well evidence-based at this stage. We have now about 70,000 published papers on the harmful effects of air pollution on the human body. So we'll look at that with a whistle-stop tour around the body, shall we? So air pollution gets into the body through the lungs, and air pollution is tightly linked with asthma, emphysema, bronchiectasis, and exacerbations of asthma and emphysema. Air pollution also worsens sleep apnea. From the lungs, air pollution is taken to the heart, and PM2.5 air pollution is extremely well associated with death from heart disease, heart attacks, and heart failure. It causes atherosclerosis, which is hardening of the arteries, and air pollution is responsible for about a quarter of all deaths from ischemic heart disease. On days of high air pollution, admissions to our hospitals increase with people with heart failure and heart attacks. And if you're on the other end of the spectrum, if you're extremely athletic, you'll do worse athletic performances, and we run slower marathons on days of high air pollution. Now, from the heart, blood is pumped to that most important of all organs, said the neurologist, which is the brain. And air pollution is really strongly linked with stroke. And in fact, air pollution causes about 20% of all stroke deaths. On days of high air pollution, we get more people coming in with stroke, and long-term exposure causes more silent strokes. A significant fraction of strokes are silent, and reduced brain volume, so it actually shrinks our brain. And in fact, there's an association between your risk of dementia and how far away you live from a major road. Air pollution is also now implicated in Parkinson's disease and motor neuron disease as well. Now, air pollution affects the mind as well as the brain, and there's a fairly good correlation between air pollution and an absolutely impressive range of mental disorders, including bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, and admissions to hospital with psychosis. Our special senses are affected as well. So air pollution affects the eye. It's linked to glaucoma, macular degeneration, cataract, and blindness. It's linked to hearing loss in adults, and it's linked to glue ear, which is a significant cause of hearing loss in children as well. There's a robust association of multiple air pollutants with liver cirrhosis, fatty liver, irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel syndrome like Crohn's disease, ulcers, and even appendicitis. Air pollution is tightly linked to autoimmune conditions like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and hay fever. Every year, 3 million cases of diabetes are attributed to PM2.5, particulate air pollution. PM2.5 is also associated with kidney disease, death from kidney disease, and again, people who live closer to major roads have reduced kidney function compared to other people. In fact, about 20% of kidney disease is attributed to PM2.5 air pollution alone, and other pollutants have an additive effect as well. Air pollution causes almost every cancer that you care to think about. So lung cancer, colon cancer, rectal cancer, liver cancer, stomach cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, and childhood leukemia. Air pollution is associated with skin aging, eczema, psoriasis, and amazingly, it's got a really strong association with acne, of all things. Disease of the year, COVID. There's an association of air pollution with COVID, and about 15% of the deaths worldwide from COVID are attributed to air pollution in the atmosphere that people breathe. So if you live in a place that's got high air pollution, you're much more likely to die when you get COVID. Air pollution even affects organs that you just think shouldn't be remotely susceptible to air pollution. So bone disease, with air pollution causing osteoporosis, that's thin bones, osteomalacia, that's weak bones, and hence unsurprisingly being associated with fractures. Air pollution reduces fertility in women and probably causes poor sperm in men. And in the womb, we are uniquely susceptible to air pollution, which is correlated with miscarriage, being born too early, and being born too small. And these are really bad for long-term health if you're born too early or too small. It's not trivial. Children are much more at risk of air pollution than adults, and exposure to air pollution in childhood, especially in that critical under five, sets us up for a lifetime of disability. I find it very poignant that of all the children that die under five, one in four of these children are dying because of pollution in the air that they breathe. And there's compelling evidence for air pollution causing impaired development of the brain, including developmental delay and reduced IQ. In fact, if you live in a place that's got lots of air pollution, that's equivalent to having 1 year's less education in your life. Children who grow up with cleaner air have bigger brains and bigger lungs. There's some evidence of an association with autism and ADHD. That one's not fully hammered out, so that one's still a bit questionable, but everything else I've been talking about, we know for sure. And I hope I've convinced you at this point that air pollution is a really big deal medically. It causes lots of disease, and it's killing about one in five of us are dying from air pollution caused purely by fossil fuels, which is the single biggest preventable cause of air pollution. To turn that around another way, the average human being is losing 13 months of life from air pollution. 13 months. That's an average for the world. In a place like Australia or New Zealand, it's probably a few months. I still want that time back.
And we know, and we'll touch on this shortly, but we talk about air pollution and then compound that with climate-related air pollution, such as fire, so the increased fire and the smoke that comes from that, sandstorms. I'm starting to think a mask mandate should stay in forever now. I mean,
we had those bushfires back a couple of years ago in obviously the eastern states, and from memory, about 35 people were killed directly from the fires. About 400 people died through indirect effects of smoke inhalation. So it's a much bigger toll that comes from the smoke from bushfires than just the bushfires directly.
And it's more widespread as well.
Absolutely.
Because the smoke travels a lot further as well. So
yeah, I mean, even it came to New Zealand, I believe.
Correct.
It's amazingly bad. It's amazingly bad for human health.
But I mean, you also talked about a lot of this air pollution being greenhouse gases. So obviously that's directly contributing to the warming climate. And as Ben said, like, in this area of the world, we often jump to thinking about extreme weather events or heat waves, but the effects are far more reaching, aren't they, in regards to the warming climate and human health?
Interestingly, the association between air pollution and climate change is nuanced. So the world overall has heated 1.1 degrees Celsius above baseline because of global heating. But if we didn't have air pollution in the atmosphere, so human-derived air pollution, we'd actually be at 1.4. So as we pull down air pollution, which hopefully we will do, that's going to have really nuanced effects on what's happening with climate change. And I'm not an expert in that. I don't have solutions there, but it's compounding and it's not simple.
So let's touch a little bit on the latest IPCC report. And really, they're all interrelated, really, because they tell us the same message. We're stuffed, to put it lightly.
That's a good summary, yeah.
But
don't be a doomer, Ben.
Give me some grounded hope here. What do we know? And one of the key things is that we know that the net. I've just tried to skip through the latest report again to our listeners. Don't bother; too many pages, too complex. But one of the key things I picked out on is that the net anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise. It just keeps getting worse. And it's had a cumulative net CO2 emissions as well since 150, 160, 70 years ago. And it's across all sectors. So emissions, that's impacting air quality. Mm. So it's only going one way, this graph.
Mm. Yeah. And yet there is still hope. That third part of the IPCC report, if you're going to summarize it, we have an enormous job ahead of us, but it can be done. It's affordable to do it, but we absolutely have to start now. We can't keep kicking the ball down the road. We've got to do it now. We have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels urgently. We cannot go on as if it's business as usual. We cannot wait for market solutions. We cannot wait for technical fixes. We have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. We're in this mess because decisions were made decades ago not to do so. And it's super urgent now that we do this. We need transformational change, not incremental change. And we need transformational leaders, not transactional leaders, which we don't currently have in Australia. And we need politics and society to change drastically. We need changes in farming. We need changes in industry. We need the fossil fuel industries to shut down in an orderly but quick fashion. We need all those workers transition to other jobs. And we need to be compassionate but sensible about this, because human civilization, if not humanity itself, is at stake. But there is hope. It can be done.
So what do you think some of the barriers to change are? Because as you said, we've been talking about this for the past 30 years. Why are we not further along down this road?
Well, actually, it goes back longer than that. Fossil fuel company scientists have known since at least the 1980s, and some sources say the 1960s, that their product was causing climate change. So great question. Why have we left it so late? And we need to talk about the villains of the story, which are fossil fuel companies. They are spending and have spent for a long time many millions of dollars to oppose climate policy and pollution policy. And they're winning. Don't have any doubt about that. They've known for decades that their product causes climate change, the same way that the tobacco industries have known that tobacco causes cancer. And they use exactly the same strategies to try and slow change. So if it's all right, can I take you through what I call the five D's of fossil fuel companies? First of all, denial. They've been putting out fake science and rogue scientists for decades now to dispute climate change science that has been well established since the 1980s. And they have therefore delayed action on climate change. We spent decades arguing about whether or not climate change was real. They knew it was real in the 1980s. Then, you know, in the noughties, we spent quite a while arguing about whether or not climate change was caused by humans or whether it was a natural phenomenon. And this was nonsense as well. We knew and they knew that it was caused by fossil fuels. There's been a lot of denigration on the way as well. So they like to paint climate scientists and environmental activists as sandal-wearing, tree-hugging hippies, rather than as sensible people concerned with the environment. You know, we get pushed to the side. They're not sensible. They want to shut down business. They aren't looking forward to the future. So we get shunted to the side, and they pretend that business people with short-term focus and a massive disregard for human suffering are speaking for the everyman, and they're absolutely not. But none of this is working anymore. There's too many people speaking up about climate change. They can't get away with denial or disinformation anymore. Yeah, there's a little bit of it going on, but basically the jig is up there. So nowadays, they've got two strategies. One is delusion. And delusion is about technologies that are just around the corner that are going to come around and save us. And the big example there is carbon capture. Carbon capture isn't viable. They've been talking about it for 25 years. We still can't do it at scale, and it doesn't make financial sense. So carbon capture is basically, yes, we can burn coal, oil and gas, and we'll take the carbon emissions and put them in the ground or otherwise get rid of it. We can't do them. We can't do them anywhere. We might be able to in the future, but we can't do them right now. It's not an excuse to urgently stop with emissions. It's just an excuse to keep fossil fuel companies in the game and to have more money shoveled towards them. But the mother of all strategies is delay. Delay, delay, delay. Putting off till tomorrow what we absolutely need to do today. And I'm going to call them out as profoundly immoral and evil, because this is done in the pursuit of profit with massive disregard for current and future human suffering. It is truly immoral. And I don't know how fossil fuel company executives are living with themselves.
Well, after all of the health issues you've just run us through, it should be criminal that they're allowed to do this.
I think that's going to be increasingly recognised, and I think current politicians that think they're going to be judged on their performance with COVID will actually ultimately have their scorecards ranked on what they've done for climate change. For example, here in Australia, just this week, a massive new coal mine has been signed off in New South Wales, and just yesterday in my own state of Western Australia, the Scarborough gas development has been signed off on, and these are incredibly wrong-headed moves, and they're immoral. And our politicians are supposed to be representing our interests. You should know better.
Exactly. And I want this next question, I kind of want to preface it by reminding people that might be feeling a little bit powerless right now listening to all of this, that by the time this episode airs, we very likely will have had an election called. So your vote matters now more than ever. So please pay attention to climate policies before you're deciding on who to vote for. But Carolyn, in your opinion, do you think Australia is doing enough on climate change right now? Are our policies going to get us to where we need to go?
All right, short answer, absolutely not. And there's so much spin coming from the government on this one, really. So I think what I saw in the news this week is our politicians, including our Prime Minister, were saying that we've cut emissions more than comparable other developed countries. And this is absolute nonsense. It's done by cherry-picking data, and it's simply not true. It's been called out by the ABC this week as being completely misleading. So let's talk about some facts here. So last year, Australia was ranked the worst country in the world by the United Nations for action on climate change. They said we're the worst of about 135-odd countries. We're right at the bottom. Compared to other countries, we're still opening new gas developments, new coal mines, new oil developments, which we've been told we absolutely can't do. We've got this loose target for net zero by 2050, but we have absolutely no plan to get there. And in fact, the plan to get there relies on technology that no one in the world has invented yet, which is insane. We're still subsidising fossil fuels to the tune of at least $10 billion a year. Well, we're starving renewables of the money they need to get up and get going. And this is because the fossil fuel industry has so infiltrated our politics that although the vast majority of Australians and New Zealanders want action on climate change, it's not happening.
Sorry, I am lining up my next question because there we go. Because we talk about Australia, because this is the thing. We talk about the D's, deferral. And deferral is, and I'm experiencing this, I should not need to be careful, I'll be cancelled. But where I'm working at the moment, I'm seeing this with the whole sustainability thing, and we're reducing our footprint because it's being deferred to externality. So someone else can take care of that exact same emission, but it's not on our books, so it won't matter. Now, my question that I was trying to line up is, you know, we talk about Australia continuing to open fossil fuel related, you know, plants, mines, etc. But Australia exports a considerable amount of those fossil fuels. And this is not verified because it's a quick Google search, but it's close to 25%.
Yeah. If I remember my own stats, I think Australia is the third biggest exporter of fossil fuels in the world, mostly
right.
Gas.
So it's very nice that a report goes and says, I'm standing up for Australia here. God, I've changed. But, you know, it's all very nice to finger point Australia and say, well, you're the worst and you're performing the worst and you're continuing to do all this. But who's benefiting from this? You know, if a country wants to be ranked in the top three, yet they're deriving the benefit from this export, who's the hypocrite?
Well, I make an analogy there, which is a drug pusher. If you're someone that sells drugs on the streets, then yes, the harm is being done to somebody else. But we don't let the drug pusher off by saying, well, I just sell them. It's up to the person whether or not we take them. And if we're selling fossil fuels, I don't think that absolves us of a responsibility for those emissions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But money's talking here, isn't it? You're getting paid to do it. The 0.1% that's going to derive the benefit.
The pursuit of profit, ignoring human suffering. I keep coming back to this because this is what it's all about.
And we've touched on a lot in a number of episodes as well that whilst a lot lies on the big corporates and governments, lifestyle choices also drive that. So we still have an active responsibility. I mean, if we're going to keep upgrading our vehicles every 2 years, we're keeping that demand alive. If we're going to keep living lavish lives in terms of consumption of, as Dr. Mike Joy always calls it, stuff, then we're keeping that demand alive. So there is still a little bit of accountability that needs to sit with us, the individual. I mean, we can't just sit back and say, it's a corporate, it's a government, there's nothing we can do.
So I guess really what this is about is how do we live sustainably? Well, I guess the first thing I would say is this is not a problem that an individual can sort out. 70% of all emissions are coming from 100 fossil fuel companies. If we don't take these companies down, nothing we do will really make a difference. So yes, every bit matters, but if we don't tackle fossil fuel companies, we're basically doomed. But what can you do as an individual that makes a difference? First of all, think about your money. Think about who you bank with, who your super is with, who your mortgage is with. There's an absolutely brilliant website called marketforces.org.au. And if And it tells you who, whether or not your financial institution invests in fossil fuels. And for example, if you're with one of the Australian big four banks, you are absolutely invested in fossil fuels. It's not that hard to change bank. If you change mortgage, I guarantee you'll get a better deal. It's not that hard to change your super. Get your money out of fossil fuels and then tell the company that you left why you did so. In terms of other changes, think about your transport. So I'm in my 40s. In my eternal quest to remain that bit thinner and that bit healthier, I've taken up cycling. I'm enjoying it. It gets me to work and back, and I'm reducing my personal emissions. My next car is going to be an electric car. I don't understand why anyone would buy a petrol car at this point. To me, it's the equivalent of buying a landline rather than a mobile phone. Flights is hard. I have family back in Scotland. How am I dealing with that? Well, I don't fly to medical conferences anymore, which I used to. I will still sometimes go back and see my mother. I think there was a paper that came out recently that said that people in the Western world were going to have to do a national flight once every 3 years and an international flight once every 8 years if we were going to be fair and reduce our contribution. And that seems tough. Flights are definitely the thing I have the most personal trouble with, having family overseas, but it is reality. Diet's a really big one, as you'll be aware of in the lentil intervention. So our current Western diet is refined, hyper-processed, incredibly meat-heavy and calorie-dense, and we see the results in the waistlines of our fellow citizens. Two-thirds of Australians are overweight or obese, and even those of us that aren't, only a fraction of us are eating our recommended 5 veg and 2 fruit a day. And this over-nutrition and malnutrition contributes hugely to heart disease, cancer, stroke, infertility, arthritis, depression and diabetes. As I said earlier, bad diet is just above pollution in terms of its appalling health effects. Now, at the same time, our food system to support this terrible diet accounts for about 12% of greenhouse gas emissions in Australia and about a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions globally. And this is causing soil erosion, over-irrigation, deforestation, biodiversity and species loss, and pollution from fertilisers. Despite this, a third of all the food we produce ends in waste, and about a billion people go hungry each year. Now, you've absolutely got to talk about red meat. So cows and beef are absolute standouts in terms of unsustainability. Two-thirds of greenhouse gas emissions coming from the food system is red meat, and beef production requires 28 times more land, 11 times more water, 6 times more nitrogen than white meat, dairy or eggs. Plant foods have about a quarter of the footprint of white meat, dairy and eggs, and yet the global trend is towards increased red meat, as less affluent countries want to be just like us in the Western world. So we need to move to a diet that's plant-rich, with no or very little meat, and avoid hyper-processed and fast food. And this will be transformative not only for our planet, but for human health as well. Otherwise, as you said, we've got to think about our vote. I wouldn't be voting for anyone that doesn't put climate action very high on the agenda. And we need to speak out. We need to speak out in our schools, our universities, our workplaces. This requires whole of society.
I don't really have much to add to that. I think that's a really perfect way to kind of wrap everything up, to be honest. Ben, any thoughts here?
No, I think, you know, it's funny because, Carolyn, you mentioned about, you know, your impact with transport, you know, moving to a bicycle and the impact it's having on your health. Physical activity is important for general health, and it's important for brain function, for cognitive function. That there's a direct link with that as well. The irony now, you know, the position I find myself, and I think I've mentioned this a few times, so I'm not going to keep boring our listeners, but, you know, I've made an active decision the last few years to no longer own a vehicle. And when I need one, I hire one. And I think it's a much, much more cost-effective way. And I'm not adding another vehicle on the road. I'm using one that's there to be hired. And part of that is I choose to live very centrally in the city so I can walk. And part of that decision is to make me more physically active. And yes, I run ultra marathons, but I still sit a lot. And it's the overall general health. With this episode now, I'm scared to step outside my front door because I'm central. It's more built up. There's more congestion, which means the air quality is worse. So now it's what's important. You know, I'm living centrally because I'm thinking that I'm being a better human when it comes to the impact on the planet, and I'm being a better human in terms of my own personal health, or am I? So it's a real now, there's two serious factors to consider, but if I live further out, nicer air, I'm going to have to buy a vehicle because public transport's just non-existent.
Ben, the evidence is actually in on this one, and clearly exercising, even with pollution, is better for our health. So you would never tell anyone not to exercise because of concerns about pollution. Now, if you live in Delhi or something and it's an incredibly horrible day, then that's probably a different matter. But in Australia and New Zealand, no question, we've got to get out there, we've got to exercise. It is far better for our mental and physical health. As a neurologist who works with dementia, physical exercise is one of the reversible causes of dementia, along with poor education, air pollution, terrible diet. So definitely, even with all the worries about air pollution, we can do a lot better on it. We have to be exercising. And I think that's wonderful that you don't have a car. I aspire to that as well. But with two children, it's not quite been practical yet.
Yeah, no, fair enough. So look, I think let's wrap it up there. It's been a fascinating conversation. And I like that part of your last delivery has been on the impact of what we eat. And we always say that the food on your plate has an impact on the environment. And in this case, we've spoken about the global emissions that comes from the growing, the manufacturing, the transport of food. It contributes to what we eat, contributes to environmental pollution as a result. And environmental pollution is not just air quality or water, it's also what's in the soil. So there's a lot of correlations there. And ultimately, our health and our cognitive function. So it's a full circle.
And can I just jump in and say that's no longer even up for debate, because that is an official recommendation in the latest IPCC report, is to eat more plant-based.
100%. 100%. So on that note, Dr. Carolyn Orr, thank you so much for giving up a little bit of your time to come onto the show and sharing with us your wisdom.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.